cared for this show while I was late.
We nurtured it.
And I'm so grateful for that. And coming up right now is Veterans Voice, so stick around for that.
Please stick around.
Marvin's going to hold it down for us, and we'll see you next time.
Bye-bye.
This is KBOO Portland, listener-powered, non-corporate community radio.
You're listening to KBOO's All Thrills, No Frills, Volume 4 Special Programming Campaign. Check out all the great special programs we're bringing you. Now through April 15th at kboo.fm/ATNF4.
Prison Pipeline is a radio program dedicated to educating the public about the Oregon criminal justice system. Topics include incarceration and reentry, addictions and mental health, elections and laws, victims' rights, and criminal justice reform. The program presents a unique understanding of the criminal justice system, addresses the root causes of crime, and challenges the status quo. It seeks to promote awareness and activism in order to foster a safer, healthier, and more just society.
Prison Pipeline airs on Monday evenings from 6:30 to 7 p.m. on KBOO Portland. Check us out every week. If you miss an episode, you can stream it later. Just go to kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. More info about upcoming shows and events related to the prison community can be found on our Facebook page, Prison Pipeline. Be sure to like us.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. The time is 9:02 a.m. Next up is Veterans Voice.
Thank you.
Portland calling. Sisters and brothers, welcome to Veterans Voice Radio Show on KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland, 104.3 FM Corvallis, 91.9 FM Hood River, or on the World Wide Web at KBOO.FM. I'm Marvin, and Ty is engineering for me, and I appreciate him. I want to say hello to Gary and Darla in Nebraska. They're celebrating their 55th wedding anniversary. And Kathy and Aloha, and Mitty and her grandchildren, great, they're wonderful grandchildren. And to my buddy Jim and Gresham, it's always good to have friends. The Next War by Wilfred Owen, a World War I veteran. Out there we walked quite friendly up to death, sat down and eaten with him, and cool and bland, pardon his spilling mist tins in our hand. We sniffed the green thick odor of his breath. Our eyes wept, but our courage didn't wither. He spat at us with bullets, and he coughed shrapnel. We chorused when we sang aloft. We whistled while he shaved us with his sickle. Oh, death was never enemy of ours. We laughed at him. We ligged with him, old chum. No soldier paid to kick against his power. We laughed, knowing that better men would come. The greater war, when each proud fighter brags his war on death for lives, not men, for flags. As Wilfred Owen, a World War I veteran and a great, great poet. And this is a poem from my favorite writer, and James Baldwin. Every bomb village is my hometown, and every dead child is my child. Every grieving mother is my mother. Every crying father is my father. Every home turned to rubble is the home I grew up in. Every brother carrying the remains of his brother across borders is my brother. Every sister waiting for a sister who will never come home is my sister. Every one of these people are ours, just like we are theirs. We belong to them, and they belong to us. James Baldwin. James Baldwin is an amazing writer. He just spoke free. He left the United States because of the racism against our sisters and brothers of African descent, and he moved to France, and he wrote some wonderful stuff out there, back there. If you want to donate to our wonderful radio station, because it's needed now more than ever with this so-called government that we have, you can send a donation to KBOO 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. Or you can go on the web at kboo.fm, and you go up where it says donate. You hit that, and you can donate that way, and we keep our station going. You know, I was just mourning all the deaths in Gaza in the West Bank. The Zionist Israeli government has killed so many people, and it's going on right now. They want to get every Palestinian out of Gaza. They want to get them all out. You know, if they can't run them out, they'll kill them out. You know, they're killing our children. They're killing our moms and our dads, and they're killing our aunts and our uncles. They're killing our grandpas and our grandmas. Every day that's going on. Every day. And this government is so guilty of killing these people, our sisters and brothers in Gaza, in the West Bank. The Zionist government of Israel has no problem killing these people. And I, for one, don't like it one bit. You know, we do everything we can to get it stopped. And we just got to keep on going until this craziness stops. With this Elon Musk and Donald Trump tramp, you know, they're cutting the government so much and they're hurting so many innocent people. They have no idea of the people that are going to be hurt by their cutting all these government organizations, you know. They're cutting the VA. I never heard of the VA ever being cut by anybody, but they plan on getting rid of 83,000 more of 70% of all the people that work there, and half of the of that 83,000 are disabled veterans that work for the VA. So they're going to lose their jobs, and that's going to be really especially in mental health, it's going to be a real problem because a lot of veterans really depend on the VA for mental health. And with the more and more women in the military now and being in combat zones, our sisters need that mental health counseling. But if they cut the staff, it's going to be a real problem. And they one of the things that that's being cut is the veterans suicide hotline. They're cutting that, and boy, I tell you, that's really a bad mistake on their part. Really a bad mistake. And you know, a lot of people don't understand, but the VA does a lot of work on different diseases, like the cancer. They have work on cancer. They work on all kinds of other things, you know, to help other people besides the veterans. And they're going to cut that. So it's a real, real, real problem, you folks. It's a real, really a problem. It's just not the VA, but boy, just a lot of craziness. My friend Kathy sent me this as soon as I can find it on my phone here, I'll tell you more about it. Here it is. Okay, Kathy sent me a thing because, you know, if they're going to start cutting, let's cut some of the military budget. But she sent me this thing that some younger person wrote. And it's really interesting. And the reason why kids aren't going into the military. They say it's a 1.3 million recruitment crisis. The number one is overweight and low aptitude test. People don't want to join up. Navy recruiters are the lowest, taking ships out of service. Army reserves have been hurting for 10 years. Army can't come up 15,000 short. Youngsters say they don't want to be hurt in the forever wars. And that was written by a young man named Dexter. And Kathy sent it to Wyden, Senator Wyden, and I think she's going to send it to Senator Merkley. With Merkley, Senator Merkley will definitely, contact her about this. And for a young child, a young kid, to come up with all this, you know, just $800 billion military budget. It's more than that now, I think. It's almost a trillion. And this is Kathy. One of the reasons why they don't want to get in the military, they don't want to get hurt in the forever war. And that sure is true. A forever war. I was looking and every morning on my altar at home, I burn incense, and I burn it for the people of Gaza, and I also burn it for Aaron Bushnell, because on February 23rd, 2024, Aaron Bushnell, a 25-year-old serviceman of the United States Air Force, died after setting himself on fire outside the front gate of the Embassy of Israel in Washington, D.C. Immediately prior to the act, which was live-streamed on Twitch, Bushnell said that he was protesting against what people have been experiencing in Palestine at the hands of their colonizers, declared that he will no longer be complicit in genocide, after which he doused himself with a flammable liquid and set himself on fire. As he burned, Bushnell repeatedly shouted, "Free Palestine." After he collapsed onto the ground, two Secret Service agents attempted to extinguish the flames, while a third covered for them with their weapon. The Metropolitan Police Department also responded to assist the Secret Service. Bushnell was transported to a local hospital in critical condition and was declared dead in the evening. Bushnell's act was the second self-immolation protesting United States support for Israel in the Gaza war, which has killed over, is 40,000 Palestinians. And I know it's way more than that now, and resulted in a major humanitarian crisis. In December 2023, in December of 2023, another protester set herself on fire at the Israeli consulate in Atlanta. Some viewed Bushnell's act as heroic and called him a martyr. Others argue that Bushnell's suicide could not be praised or viewed as a legitimate form of political protest, warning that about copycats who might imitate him. I tried to find the name of that woman that set herself on fire in Atlanta, and I could not find it. They never put it in the newspapers, I don't think, as the reason she set herself on fire. But Bushnell grew up in Orleans, Massachusetts, in the isolated Christian community of Jesus Compound. He attended Nanset Regional High School and worked for a Brewster in Massachusetts-based Christian book, music, and video publishing company. He told a friend that he left the community in 2019. And he joined the military in 2020, having completed basic and technical training. It just goes through what he did in his younger life and what he did in the military. And Bushnell used Reddit account username AceBush1. He just talks about and wrote a comment about the Israeli civilians murdered by Hamas at the Nova Music Festival. Those people's fun at the music festival was specifically built on Palestinian suffering. There are no innocent civilians in settler colonialism. He also called Hamas an anti-colonial resistance organization, and according to one of his friends who was with him on October 7th, their reaction to Hamas attack, they didn't print this too well, they broke out of their prison. I can't read that too much, but they accused him of having a mental problem and all sorts of different things to try to get it away from why he really did it. And he did it because of Israel's attack and killing of innocent Palestinians. You know, when a country such as Israel stops water going into Gaza, electricity, food, medicine, and other needed commodities is a horrible thing that the whole world is watching but have done nothing to bring it to an end. I listened to a woman who is a doctor, and she was in Gaza, and she's working in the hospital, and this is with this new round of Israel broke the peace compact that they had and started attacking the Palestinians. And she was saying that she's noticing how many children have been killed by the Israeli bombing of Palestine. She said these children are so malnourished, so skinny, that it just, she said that it, if they lived, how were they gonna fight off death when they were so hungry? She was so upset. She was a young doctor too. She was a very young doctor, and she said how much it bothered her, but that she had to be there. She had to be there to help the Palestinians. And boy, I understand that. But even though she's a trained doctor, seeing all this death of children just really bothered her a lot. And she had to quit talking because it was bothering her so much. I had lunch with my good friend Mike Hasty on March 16th down in Portland. And Mike's been on this on the show with me a few times. He introduced me to my late wife, but he's also a very great peace activist, a veteran. He was a medic in Vietnam. He's a very good writer. He writes some really good stuff, and he has some really good photographs. And we were talking about our time in Vietnam and how it affected us, and how it not only affected us personally, but how it affected our families. So also, you know, my father, he was a World War II veteran. He fought in North Africa, in Italy. He was a reconnaissance trooper. But, you know, he never really got over the war, what happened to him and what he did in the war. My father never got over that. And as I look back on things, you know, and having PTSD, chronic severe PTSD myself, I could understand how my father was dealing with it when, you know, when I was growing up. And my mother, during the war, she worked in a bomber factory, and she worked riveting on bombers. That was her job, was a riveter on the bombers. But Mom never really talked much about what was happening to her or of what was happening to my father. So, and my father and I talked about things, you know, before I went to Vietnam. And then when I came back, we talked a little some, but not a lot. But the reason Mike and I had dinner, we sat and talked at the Virginia Cafe in downtown Portland. It was like we got there at 2 o'clock and we left at 7. We sat there and talked for 5 hours. On my phone, I have Free Gaza, and I had my phone laying down, and the waitress came over to give it, to bring our drinks and the food we were having, and she says, "I agree with that 100%. And I thought, there's a lot of people out there that do. But March 16th, 1968, in My Lai and Mike, a company of infantrymen went into that hamlet area and they slaughtered 502 innocent people. They slaughtered children. They slaughtered old people. They slaughtered anybody and everybody. They rounded people up, put them in an irrigation ditch, and killed them all. This is the My Lai Massacre. It was the Maricao Division. And some very interesting stuff. My Lai Massacre was a United States war crime committed on 16 March 1968 involving the mass murder of unarmed civilians at Son Mai Village, Quang Nai Province, South Vietnam during the American War in Vietnam. Up to, they say, 504 civilians, almost all women and children and elderly men and women, were murdered by U.S. Army soldiers from C Company, 1st Battalion, 20th Infantry Brigade, 20th Infantry Regiment, 11th Brigade, and B Company, 4th Battalion, 3rd Infantry Regiment, 11th Brigade of the 24th Infantry Division, which is the Americal Division. Some of the women were gang raped and their bodies mutilated, and some soldiers mutilated and raped children as young as 12. The incident was the largest massacre of civilians by U.S. forces in the 20th century. On the morning of the massacre, C Company, commanded by Captain Ernest Medina, was sent into one of the villages, hamlets, it was My Lai, for expecting to engage the Viet Cong local forces of the 48th Battalion, which was not present. The killing began while the troops were searching the village for guerrillas, and continues after they realized that no guerrillas seemed to be present. Villagers were gathered together, held in the open, and murdered with automatic weapons, bayonets and hand grenades. One large group of villagers was shot in an irrigation ditch. Soldiers also burned down homes and killed livestock. Warrant Officer Hugh Thompson Jr. and his helicopter crew are credited with attempting to stop the massacre. Nearby B Company killed 60 to 155 of the victims in the hamlet of Mi K, which is very near My Lai. The massacre was originally reported as a battle against Viet Cong troops and was covered up in an initial investigation by the U.S. Army. The efforts of veteran Ronald Ridenhour and journalist Seymour Hersh broke the news of the massacre to the American public in November of 1965. Prompting global outrage and contributing to the domestic opposition to the involvement in the war. 26 soldiers were charged with criminal offenses, but only Lieutenant William Kelly Jr., the leader of the 1st Platoon and C Company, was convicted. He was found guilty of murdering 22 villagers and originally given a life sentence, but served 3.5 years under house arrest. And then Richard Nixon commuted his sentence. Why don't you go ahead and play that second song for me, will you please?
Come gather around, people, wherever you roam, and admit that the waters around you have grown, and accept it that soon you'll be drenched to the bone. If your time to you is worth saving, then you better start swimming or you'll sink like a stone. For the times, they are a-changing. Writers and critics who prophesize with your pen, and keep your eyes wide, the chance won't come again. And don't speak too soon, for the wheel's still in spin, and there's no telling who that it's naming. For the loser now will be later to win, for the times, they are a-changing. Senators, congressmen, please heed the call. Don't stand in the doorway, don't lock up the hall. For he that gets hurt will be he who has stalled. The battle outside raging will soon shake your windows and rattle your walls. For the times, they are a-changing.
mothers and fathers throughout the land. And don't criticize what you can't understand. Your sons and your daughters are beyond your command. Your old road is rapidly aging. Please get out of the new one if you can't lend your hand. For the times, they are a-changing. The line it is drawn, the curse it is cast. The slow one now will later be fast, as the present now will later be past. The order is rapidly fading, and the first one now will later be last. For the times, they are a-changing.
On the eve, are we ready? On the eve of the attack, Charlie Company's briefing, Captain Ernest Medina told his men that nearly all the civilian residents of the hamlet at San Mi village would have left for the market by 7 o'clock, and that any who remained would most likely be VC or VC sympathizer. He was asked whether the order included the killing of women and children. Those present later gave a differing account of Medina's response. Some, including platoon leaders, testified that the orders, as they understood, were to kill all VC and North Vietnamese combatants and suspects, including women and children, as well as all animals, to burn the village and pollute the wells. He was quoted as saying, "They're all VC, now go and get them," and was heard to reply to the question, "Who is my enemy?" by saying, "Anybody that was running from us, hiding from us, or appeared to be an enemy. If a man was running, shoot him. Sometimes if a woman with a rifle was running, shoot her." At Lieutenant Calley's trial, one defense witness testified they remember Medina instructing to destroy everything in the village that was walking, crawling, or growling. Fernando Simpson, a rifleman in Charlie Company, said, "We were told to leave nothing standing. We did what we were told, regardless of whether they were civilians." Instead of expected enemy, the GIs found women, children, old men, many of whom were cooking breakfast over outdoor fires. The villagers were getting ready for a market day, and at first did not panic or run away as they were herded into the hamlet's common space and homestead yards. Harry Stanley, a machine gunner from Charlie Company, said during the U.S. Army Criminal Investigation Division inquiry that the killing started without warning. He first observed a number of 1st Platoon strike a Vietnamese man with a bayonet. Then the same trooper pulled another villager and threw another villager into a well and threw a grenade in the well. Nixie saw 15 or 20 people, mainly women and children, kneeling around the temple burning incense. They were praying and crying. They were all killed by shots to their head. I know this is hard, but it's true. PFC Private First Class Dennis Conte, a witness for the prosecution to one of the especially gruesome episodes during the shooting. "A lot of women had thrown themselves on top of the children to protect them, and the children were alive at first. Then the children who were old enough to walk got up, and Caleb began to shoot the children. Other First Platoon members testified that many of the deaths of individual Vietnamese men, women, and children occurred inside My Lai during the security sweep to ensure the hamlet could no longer offer support to the enemy. The livestock was shot as well. When PSC Michael Bernhardt entered the hamlet, the massacre was underway. I walked up and saw these guys doing strange thing, setting fires to hooches and huts and waiting for people to come out and then shooting them. Going into the hooches and shooting them up, gathering people in groups and shooting them. As I walked in, you could see piles of people all throughout the village, all over. They were gathered up into large groups. I saw them shoot them with M79 grenade launchers into a group of people who were still alive, but it was mostly done with machine guns. They were shooting women and children just like anybody else. We met no resistance, and I only saw three captured weapons. We had no casualties. It was just like any other Vietnamese village, old Papa San's, women and kids. As a matter of fact, I don't remember seeing one military age male in the entire place, dead or alive. You know, there was one casualty, American casualty, during this horrendous attack on My Lai, and that was a soldier of African descent who shot himself in the foot because he didn't want to be involved in what was happening all around him. One of the pictures you can see, I went to My Lai twice, once in 94 and again in, I think, 2000 with my late wife. And I've never seen her cry so hard in my whole life as she cried that day as we went through My Lai. I just never saw her cry that hard. Ronald Herbley, eyewitness account of the massacre in one instant. There were some South Vietnamese people, maybe 15 of them, women and children included, walking on a dirt road maybe 100 yards away. All of a sudden, the GIs just opened up with M16s. Besides M64, they were shooting at people with M79 grenade launchers. I couldn't believe what I saw. Callie, Lieutenant Callie, remember, he's the only one that got convicted. But he got off. He lived until he was 80 years old. Here are these people. May 16th, 1968 was the last day they took a breath. And nobody paid a price for that. Nobody. Oh, man. Okay. There was three heroes of that whole thing. Helicopter crew intervention. Warrant Officer Hugh Thompson Jr., a helicopter pilot from Company B Aero Scouts, 123rd Aviation Battalion, America Division, saw dead and wounded civilians as he was flying over the village of Son Mai, providing close air support for ground forces. The crew made several attempts to radio for help for the wounded. They landed their helicopter by the ditch. Remember I told you about the ditch? And they just herded people in there? Which they noted was full of bodies in which they could discern movement by survivors. Thompson asked the sergeant he encountered there, David Mitchell of 1st Platoon, if he could help get the people out of the ditch, the sergeant replied that he would help them out of their misery. Thompson, shocked and confused, then spoke to Second Lieutenant Callie, who claimed to be just following orders. As a helicopter took off, Thompson saw Mitchell fire into the ditch. Thompson and his crew witnessed an unarmed woman being kicked and shot at point-blank range by Medina. Remember, Captain Medina, company commander, who got off, who later claimed that he thought she had a hand grenade. Thompson then saw a group of civilians at a bunker being approached by ground personnel. Thompson landed and told his crew that if the soldiers shot at the villagers while he was trying to get them out of the bunker, then they were to open fire on the soldiers. Thompson later testified that he spoke with a lieutenant identified as Stephen Brooks of 2nd Platoon and told him there were women and children in the bunker and asked the lieutenant would help get them out. According to Thompson, the lieutenant said the only way to get them out was with a hand grenade. Thompson testified that he then told Brooks to just hold your men right where they were and I'll get the kids out. He found 12 to 60 people in the bunker, coaxed them out, and led them to the helicopter, standing with them while they were flown out of the into groups. Returning to My Lai, Thompson and other air crew members noticed several large groups of bodies. Spotting some survivors in the ditch, Thompson landed again. A crew member, Specialist Glenn Andrade, Andrade was killed, I think, a month later in another mission, entered the ditch and returned with the bloodied but apparently unharmed 4-year-old girl who was then flown to safety. Upon returning to the landing zone, Dottie base, in his helicopter, Thompson reported to his section leader, Captain Barry Lloyd, that the American infantry was no different than Nazis in the slaughter of innocent civilians. It's mass murder out there. They're rounding them up and herding them into ditches and then just shooting them. Thompson then reported what he had seen to his company commander, Major Frederick W. Watt, using terms such as murder, needless and unnecessary killing. Thompson's statements were confirmed by other helicopter pilots and the air crew. For his actions at My Lai, Thompson was awarded Distinguished Flying Cross, while his crew members Glenn Andrade and Lawrence Coburn were awarded the Bronze Stars. Glenn Andrade was awarded his medal posthumously as he was killed in Vietnam in 8 April 1968. As the citations included a fabricated account of rescuing a young girl from My Lai from intense crossfire, Thompson threw his medal away. He later received a Purple Heart for other services in Vietnam. In March 1998, the helicopter crew's medals were replaced by the Soldier's Medal, the highest the U.S. Army can award for bravery not involving a direct conflict. The medal citations state they were for heroism above and beyond the call of duty by saving the lives of at least 10 Vietnamese civilians during an unlawful massacre of noncombatants by American forces at My Lai. Thompson initially refused to accept the medals when the U.S. Army wanted to award it quietly. He demanded it be done publicly and that his crew be honored the same way. This is really hard to read because I was in Vietnam when this happened. Oh, here we go. The following day, March 28th, the commander of Task Force Barker submitted a combat action report for the 16 March operation, in which he stated that the operation in My Lai was a success, with 128 Viet Cong combatants killed. The Americal Division Commander General Costers sent a congratulatory message to Charlie Company. General William Westmoreland, head of Military Command Vietnam, also congratulated Charlie Company, 1st Battalion, 20th Infantry, for outstanding action, saying that they had dealt the enemy a heavy blow. Later, he changed his stance, writing in his memoir that it was the conscious massacre of defenseless babies, children, mothers, and old men in a kind of diabolical, slow-motion nightmare that went on for the better part of a day. It was cold-blooded, with a cold-blooded break for lunch. Owing to the chaotic circumstance of the war and the U.S. Army's decision not to undertake a definitive body count of non-combatants in Vietnam, the number of civilians killed at My Lai cannot be stated with certainty yet. Can estimates vary for source from 347 to 504 being the most commonly cited figure. The memorial at the massacre site lists 504 names, with ages ranging from 1 to 82 years old. Investigation cover-up. Oh, man. It would indeed be terrible to find it necessary to believe that an American soldier that harbors such racial intolerance and disregard for justice and human feeling is a prototype of all American national characters. Yet the frequency of such soldiers lends credibility to such beliefs. What has been outlined here, I have seen not only in my own unit, but also in others we have worked with, and I fear it is universal. If this is indeed the case, it is a problem which cannot be overlooked, but can through a more firm implementation of the codes of Uniform Code of Military Justice and the Geneva Convention. Now here's a guy's name you all know. Colin Powell, then a 31-year-old Army major serving as Assistant Chief of Staff of Operation for the Americal Division, was charged with investigating the letter that was sent, talking about what happened, which did not specifically refer to My Lai, as Glenn had limited knowledge of the events there. In his report, Powell wrote, this betrayal is the fact that relations between American soldiers and the Vietnamese people are excellent. A 2018 U.S. Army case study of the massacre noted that Powell's investigation of allegations described in the letter, he proved unable to uncover either widespread unnecessary war crimes are any fashion related to My Lai. Powell's handling of the assignment was later characterized by some observer as whitewashing the atrocities at My Lai. In May 2004, Powell, then United States Secretary of State, told CNN, "I was in a unit that was responsible for My Lai. I got there after My Lai happened. So in war, these sort of horrible things happen every now and again, but they are still to be deplored. See, he's lying. He's flat out lying, because he was told exactly what happened at My Lai. Oh, man. The story threatened to undermine the U.S. war efforts and severely damage the Nixon presidency. Inside the White House, officials privately discussed how to contain the scandal. On November 21st, National Security Advisor, Henry Kissinger, emphasized that the White House needed to develop a game plan to establish a press policy and maintain a unified line in its public response. The White House established a My Lai task force whose mission was to figure out how best to control the problem, to make sure administration officials all don't go in different directions when discussing the incident, and to engage in dirty tricks. These included discrediting key witnesses and questioning Hersh's motives for releasing the story. What soon followed was a public relations offensive by the administration designed to shape how My Lai would be portrayed in the press and understanding of the American public. Whew. Oh, man. It was called the Piers. General William R. Piers did a survey on what happened. The 1st Battalion members had killed at least 175 to 201 Vietnamese men, women, and children. The evidence includes that only 3 or 4 were confirmed as Viet Cong, although there were undoubtedly several unarmed Viet Cong men, women, and children among them, and many more active supporters and sympathizers. One man from the company was reported as wounded from an accidental discharge of his weapon. That's the guy who shot himself in the foot. Hugh Thompson, the pilot, had interviewed during the massacre, said to the Pierce report, "The Army had Lieutenant General William R. Pierce conduct the investigation. He conducted a very thorough investigation. Congress did not like his investigation at all because he pulled no punches, and he recommended court-martial for I think, 34 people, not necessarily for the murder, but for the cover-up also. Really, the cover-up phase was probably as bad as, I don't think so, as bad as the massacre itself." In 1966, an American journalist, Jonathan Schell, wrote that in Vietnam province of Quang Nai, where the My Lai massacre occurred, up to 70% of all the villages were destroyed by airstrikes and artillery bombardment, including the use of napalm. 40% of the population were refugees, and the overall civilian casualties for the year was 50,000. Regarding the massacre of My Lai, he stated, "There can be no doubt that such an atrocity was possible only because a member of other methods of killing civilians and destroying their village had come to be the rule and not the exception in our conduct of the war." During the 4-month-long trial, Cowley consistently claimed that he was following orders from his commanding officer, Captain Medina. Despite that, he was convicted and sentenced to life in prison on 29 March 1971 after being found guilty of premeditated murder of not fewer than 20 people. 2 days later, then-President Richard Nixon made the controversial decision to have Kelly released from armed custody at Fort Benning, Georgia, and put under house arrest. Pending
You're listening appeal to KBOO Portland at 90.7 FM.
Goodbye.
As part of the All Thrills, No Frills special programming campaign, Comics Take co-host comedian Kimberly Nickel is producing a stand-up comedy show celebrating Women's History Month with a full cast of not-dude comedians, sharing their best PG-13